everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com, the Heritage Radio Network, or, of course, download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm just great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well.
We want to talk today about an incident that happened in Southern Nevada. The health department in the Southern Nevada Health District shut down recently a dinner on a farm. It was a farm-to-table dinner, and it seems like it was the first one that they had done. And they opened it to the public, and they charged for it, and they had a table set out on the farm. And it was a beautiful day and everything was going great, but it wound up that the dinner got shut down by the health department.
You know, some of our listeners have come to dinners like this that we've done, and they're done all across the country now.
And they were told their food was unfit for consumption. Well, here's what happened. The Southern Nevada, the people who are running the farm had hired a certified chef, had a certified food van that was approved. They got a notice from the Southern Nevada Health Department that they had found they were doing this, and they said that because it was a public event, they would be required to apply for a special use permit, and if they didn't do so, they'd be charged some crazy fine for basically running a pop-up restaurant.
Right, and they were notified 2 days before the event.
So they you know, Nevada things are a long way from other things, and so they got in the car, and they went and they paid the fee, and they filled out all the paperwork, and they were told that they would not be able to have the event until they had an inspection, but that an inspection could happen in the appropriate time. So while the guests are there, because let's be fair to the health department, they only have 2 days' notice, the health inspector comes and starts inspecting everything and basically shuts the whole thing down. Certified chef, legally a chef in, you know, passed all the certifications in Nevada.
Some of the reasons for shutting it down are tremendous, though.
In a certified kitchen. Well, why don't we go through a couple of the reasons why things are shut down. The health department, it seems, found some things that had been prepared in other kitchens and sealed and sent over for reheating. And those things were found to be not up to the top temperature.
But they were sealed in a restaurant, and they were not at temperature. They were already cooked.
Right.
So they were never designed to go back up to the temperature at which they were cooked.
And here are the reasons that are listed, and we're going to give you the link to a distinctiveworld.net where you can find a link to this story. And you can also find it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll put a link to the article written by the farm and the video.
Right, there's also a video of this happening.
But, you know, it raises some interesting questions. And I have to say, in many parts of the country, you find health inspectors who know how to inspect packaged, pre-processed, labeled food, or to in ways that that would disallow some really wholesome, good food.
Before you get started, I want to talk about my favorite one first. And my favorite one is they did not have receipts for the produce at the farm.
Farm.
Okay. The reason they didn't have receipts for the produce at the farm is because they
the tree didn't give them one. Is that why? Because the tree didn't have a printer on it.
I mean, there's got to be a modicum of common sense when you walk onto a farm and say you don't have receipts for this produce. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You just have to have a moment of common sense.
And you know, the vegetables which had been prepared in advance had to be thrown out because they were cut in advance. And here it says, I don't know quite what this is. Remember, this is written by the farmer. Mm-hmm. They say they were considered a biohazard. And you can see that they made them throw out all the food.
Including whole produce, including whole pears and
which is,
whole pieces of produce that were still untouched.
Which is insane. Here's some other things they found. Some of the prepared food packages did not have labels on them. And it turns out if you read the code actually allows that if it's consumed within 72 hours, it doesn't have to have a label.
Which if you're preparing a dinner like this, of course they were prepared within 72 hours.
So, and some of the food that was prepared in advance, I talked about the temperature. And it just seems as though, you know, when you look on the film at the health officials, this falls out of the pre-processed food that's really bad for you. It falls out of their purview of what they know. And so they are they are considered a biohazard. Things that your grandmother would consider great food.
Exactly.
They consider it a biohazard. You had so you had them say, okay, listen, if we can we just keep the food and my family will eat it ourselves? And I said, well, no, you can't do that. And to be honest with you, I understand. What if they, you know, the health department then leaves the property mm-hmm. And what they implied was they said, if you tell all these people you've charged to be here to leave, then you can keep the food. Mm-hmm. That seems to be implied. I don't really have a problem with that. The other thing that they said, though, is they said, can we just make all of these people part of our farm cooperative, not charge mm-hmm. them for the dinner, and then it's a private event and it's outside of your purview? And they say, you know, the health inspectors got very upset.
Right, got upset that they were trying to skirt the law.
Well, and also I think that the health inspectors are really, in many jurisdictions, the health inspectors are trained, don't really know much about food and food safety, really, except inside the box of corporate mm-hmm. environment. Mm-hmm. And what she said was that they were aghast that these people would serve this food that they raised on their farm to their family? What? I'm aghast at the Cheetos that you eat. You know what
right.
I mean? Please,
right,
you know.
Precisely.
So the only thing that's on here that I think really, to look at both sides of things. One of the problems was they were serving meat that was not USDA inspected.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if you know anything about farming, if you know anything about raising animals, if you know anything about restaurants, all meat has to be USDA inspected. And whether that's right or wrong, and frankly, I am somewhat sympathetic to that idea. I mm-hmm. think that the inspections process is geared against small farmers. It's geared to make it possible for big corporations to be able to do it, not small farmers. But that slaughtering animals has to be inspected, I don't have a huge problem with it.
And served to the public, right?
Right. If you're charging the public in a restaurant type of venue, which mm-hmm. is what this was, we have to serve you. If I go kill a deer, I can't
correct
slaughter it and sell it here in the right. restaurant. I'm sort of okay with that.
Yeah. So, I agree. If they had made them get rid of the meat, I and said you can have the rest of your event, I don't think that we'd be talking about it right now.
And here's another thing that I have to say, and I think that the food officials and health department officials often swoop down in crazy ways to come down on people who are trying to produce food in an alternative way. But you know if you don't know that you can't serve non-USDA meat, mm-hmm. then you need to know that. You need to know the regulatory environment in which you exist, even if you want to change it.
But at the same time, if you're on a farm, you should be able to eat the produce that comes off of that
but
farm.
But if you invite 150 people onto your farm and you make your farm into a restaurant for a day...
But you should still be able to eat the produce that comes off of that
the
farm.
The produce, yes, absolutely.
Without question. There's no question. I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but I was up picking strawberries at a local farm one day and with my family. And the farm was a health inspector came to the farm, and the reason they had come to the farm was to make sure that the farm was not selling pies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it was illegal for the farm to sell pies. And I just, you know, it was one of those things where I was like, you know, couldn't you come in and inspect their kitchen and make sure that they were making pies in a proper way and sell the pies from the produce that they were producing? Why I never got a good answer as to why it was not okay for that farm to sell pies if it had been properly inspected to produce pies.
Yep.
But it was indeed, you know, it had to come from a commissary kitchen, and so the farm was not allowed to sell pies. And I never quite got a good answer there.
Well, the thing about this is that really makes it realize that the health department here, in their ignorance of the fact that they support some really unhealthy foods,
mm-hmm.
and they don't even get why, you know, how outrageous that a farmer would serve food to people. You know,
right.
It's outside their purview. But they took. They made them throw out all of the food, including the produce. That mm-hmm. you know, that was crazy. And the family said, "Okay, listen, can we just take this in the back and can my family eat it tomorrow?" And then they said no. And they said, "Well, can you just take away the beef? You know, the non-USDA meat, take it away." No, they made them destroy everything, or they were going to call the police on them. And then they said, "Okay, listen, we're a farm. Can we just throw dirt on it and work the non-meat
they
stuff
into
our
feed it to the pigs.
In our compost mm-hmm. or our pig feed?" You know, couldn't compost it, couldn't pig feed it.
Well, they couldn't. No, that's not true. They couldn't compost it because they made them pour bleach.
That's
on
what
it.
I mean. That's what I mean.
That's why they couldn't compost it, because it
right.
was bleach ridden.
Right.
They couldn't feed it, but they wouldn't allow them to feed it to the pigs. And I just really like have you seen what we feed to our pigs?
No, it was crazy.
Operations.
It was really, really crazy. So if you go there, if you go to our website, you will find links to this article, and you'll also find some links to an organization that is the Farm to Consumer, an advocate for farm to consumer produce and food production, which contains a lot of examples like this from across America, and it's a pretty interesting thing to look at. We're going to be talking with a really wonderful purveyor of responsibly raised meat in just a moment. His name is George Faison, and he's been writing a lot of really cool stuff, and he also makes some very tasty meat himself. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today, in the spirit of full disclosure, is actually a purveyor of ours from whom we buy a lot of meat and specialty products. His name is George Faison, and he's a co-owner of DeBraga and Spittler right here in New Jersey.
Hey, George. Nice to finally get you on the show.
It's wonderful to be here.
So we've gotten you on the show because we want to ask you for a discount right here in public. No, that's
not a problem. Yeah. So just raise the volume about twice, three times, and I'll give you all the discounts.
Always the businessman. Well, George, one of the reasons we asked you to come on the show, and I know that you know this, but for those out in listener land, George's philosophy on meat and purchasing meat and raising meat really is congruent with our own and what we do in our restaurants and what we talk about on this show all the time. And so we have this relationship with George as a purveyor who acquires product and helps us to find good product, humanely raised animals. But also of late, George, you've been writing quite a bit, and you've become a real voice for humane animal husbandry. I didn't know you could write.
Well, you know, it's good. Thank God for spell check, you know. It's a wonderful thing. But, you know, writing, talking, however I can get the word out, I think it's important to put one's positions out there. Life's short, and good food is also in short supply, so people need to be more aware of it.
So talk to us about what you've been writing about, because I think that you have written about it really eloquently. And, you know, one of the things that we bring to the world is, as restaurant operators who do a radio show, but primarily what we do is operate restaurants, and we do a lot of public speaking and talking, but we consult for other restaurants and we run our own restaurants. But, you know, part of this show is there is a message to be gotten out, and I think you speak eloquently about it as well. Where have you been writing? How are you getting the word out? What's your audience, and how are you reaching them? And let's talk about what you're saying as well.
Well, the audience is basically my restaurant chefs and friends and various journalists that I've become acquainted with over the years. And, you know, I kind of have an in-house little distribution list that I title affectionately, I title it Propaganda, because it is my beliefs, and I hope to get more and more people to sign on to them. But over the 25 years I've been involved in the meat industry in many levels, I've become more and more convinced that the better an animal is raised, the better it tastes, and that when food tastes good, people eat it and they enjoy it. But the other context of that is that it's better for our health, it's better for the animal's health, and it's also better for the environment in which that animal's raised, as well as for the person who raises it. And this is in conjunction or in contrast with the factory food system that's developed in this country that now represents 99% of all the animal protein we consume. So the alternative is quickly disappearing, and I just felt that it was important to start pounding this message any way I could. And interestingly, one of my letters to the chefs that I put out last fall was picked up by Mark Bittman, who's the op-ed writer of the New York Times, and he put it on his blog. And then subsequently got a lot of response back from that, and just with my own in-house distribution, have been sending these messages out when things come up, like Louise Slaughter's efforts, the representative from New York, who's been really pushing the FDA to ban the use of antibiotics in the production of animals. And the when messages like that, for example, come out, I send it out to the group and say, hey, are you aware of this? Support her. Call your congressman. We even put the links to the various representatives, so that, you know, democracy is a very participatory game, but unfortunately too many of us don't participate. That's it in a nutshell.
We're going to put the link up to Mark Bittman's blog because, you know, George, obviously we, being in your client base, have get your letters all the time, and hopefully you read ours. But when it went out to Bittman's blog, a lot of people read that. A lot of people who aren't chefs and in the industry read that. And it was just so well-reasoned and so well-argued.
You know, I think, George, a lot of people are looking at their fruits and vegetables, and they're looking at the things that they're growing in their backyard, and they're seeing the difference in the way they treat, let's say, a tomato from the tomato you would buy on a supermarket shelf. And I think that what is important that we do as radio show hosts, and you do as meat purveyor, is maybe help translate that to the next level, which is our, you know, our meat production. You know, we see it's obvious to us that if we treat our tomato plant better, we're going to get a better tomato. But maybe it's less obvious that if we treat our cattle better, we're going to get better meat.
Well, the real issue here, too, is that we live in a capitalist economy, a capitalist structure. I believe in capitalism. I am a capitalist. I have a business. I like to make money so I can spend it on wonderful things. But there's a flaw with capitalism, and it's not just, say, in a financial market that goes astray selling subprime mortgages. Anything that's making a lot of money is going to continue to be invested in and pursued. And if it turns out that there's something that's detrimental to society involved in it, it's going to take a lot to get that identified and fixed. If you will, it's hard to get a train back in the station once it's rolling down the track 100 miles an hour. And you came up with a factory farming system, particularly for poultry and for hogs and for dairy animals, and the feedlot aspect of beef raising that was extremely efficient. And this efficiency was found on the farms, which turned into these large barns that were completely confined, no access to fresh air or sunshine, but at the same time, densely packed animals fed a very strict, efficient diet. The genetics for those animals were maximized, were tweaked so that the feed consumption would maximize into flesh production. And all of a sudden, these animals became widgets, but the cost of that was that their flavor declined.
I was just about to say, you know, there's one, I think, very lucky part of this for us. And I'm going to let you go into the rest of the costs of it in just a second. The very lucky thing of all of this is that the flavor declines. So we get a product that's not as good. So while you talk about the other costs, I think the way to combat this is, it's not as good a product, and I think that's how you get the train back in the station. Go ahead. I'm sorry. What are the other costs?
And you're absolutely right. Is that, you know, the health aspect, not just in terms of the animals, is the impact on the people consuming it. So we are able to buy all this animal flesh real cheap, and we've gotten used to buying it real cheap. And it's, you guys are pretty an exception to a rule. Fortunately, it's changing, but a lot of restaurants are used to buying ingredients real cheap, because if they charge more, if they buy more expensive ingredients, they got to charge more on the menu, and then the customers are resistant to, you know, to paying more, et cetera, et cetera. The downside of that is that people, because they aren't getting any gustatory satisfaction from what they consume, are not finding themselves satisfied, so they tend to eat more. And by eating more, we now have a situation where over 40% of our population is overweight or obese. Low-income children are 40% obese. I mean, we've created a health urgency in this country that we can't ignore. I mean, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff came out last year and said, we can't get enough people applying for the military that are in decent enough shape coming in that we can get them in shape to be soldiers in a training time that we allot. So they say that we have a crisis in our national diet because of the condition of young people coming into recruitment centers.
Well,
that's an astounding indictment. That's not a wacko like me saying that this is bad food. This is the military saying we got a problem.
Well, look at, you know, I want to go back to the capitalist argument for a moment, because Mark and I started our own business at 26 and 27 years old, and we've always made And before that, we were bartenders and worked mostly on tips. Mark and I are about as capitalist as you get. And I like small business, and I like the capitalist system.
And I like making money.
And I don't mind paying my fair share of the burden along the way, because I certainly get the benefits of this clean and safe city that we live in here in New Brunswick, New Jersey. But I think that capitalism has to exist in the role of government is to regulate capitalism to the extent that it's a level playing field and it's fair play. And what these large confinement animal feeding operations do is they're able to keep the profits in the private sector, externalize the costs, which is to say, okay, society is going to have to pay for the fact that we don't have enough soldiers that we can get into the army. Society is going to have to pay for the fact that we have a tremendous obesity crisis. Society is going to pay for the fact that even though we have, in a crazy, weird juxtaposition, we have fat people who are malnourished in many ways. And society is going to, you know, you said in your sort of, when you laid out things earlier, you said, you know, we had a system where it was good for the consumer who got a good product, it was good for the farmer who got a good price, and it was good for the community around that farm. And here what we've done with some of these large confinement animal feeding operations and large slaughterhouses, it's not good for the worker. Because they are so large, they're often the only employer in town, the only game in town. So it's often dangerous conditions because the oversight isn't what it should be, because the regulatory agencies are often in the pocket of the large producer. So it's not good for the farm worker. It's certainly not good. It's not great for the consumer because of many things, including the fact that a lot of stuff that goes into your animals is not labeled. So people say, oh, we should have a choice to make whatever you want. Yeah, an informed choice to make whatever you want, which we don't have. And the costs that are externalized from running these environmentally irresponsible operations, often whole towns stink. Their water supplies are in danger from fertilizer runoff. We have dead zones in our rivers and streams. We're becoming, and you touched on antibiotics, because 70% of the antibiotics produced go into non-therapeutic animal feed.
I've seen that number to be as high as 80 as well, as high as 80%.
So, well, the fact that, yeah, go
well,
ahead.
Well, and so the externalized cost is we as a society are finding diseases and infections that are resistant to antibiotics. Our antibiotics don't work anymore. Well, there's a cost to that in the billions of dollars. Yet the people who are profiting from these very efficient farming operations are reaping all of the profits but making society pay the cost. So I don't think it's anti-capitalist for society to come in and say, ho, wait a second. You're polluting the rivers, you're polluting the streams, you're making the doctor's antibiotics not work in the hospital anymore. You can't do that. You know, or if you do that, you got to pay for it.
You know, George,
and there's a single reason why nobody's jumping up and down as loudly as they should. You know, you say this one-on-one, and it makes total sense. Why aren't we doing anything about it? The reason's very simple. No one lives in rural communities anymore. They don't see the effluence problem. They don't smell the effluence problem. They're not working in the conditions, particularly to be an indoor worker at one of these factory farms. So this piece of the externalized cost is not visible, per se, to the producer. Now, Michael Pollan tried to make that
to the consumer, to people. You mean. Not visible to the consumer, yeah.
Right, not visible to the consumer. Michael Pollan tried to make this aware to people by putting out a really simple fact. 30 years ago, we spent upwards of 14% of our income on food and 6% on medical care. Now, we're spending 16% on medical care and 9% on food. So 25% of our income's involved, a disproportionate amount of that is for health care. So we are a sicker society, even though we're paying less for food. Something got lost in this mix. And the consumer, because of all the misinformation or the lack of information, isn't able to make the choice that they need to. Because for me, it's very simple. Hey, let's outlaw this stuff. Let's pull back. You know, we can give antibiotics to animals if they get sick, not to keep them from getting sick.
The same way we give them to people.
Absolutely. Now,
would you give your kid antibiotics every day, knowing what you know about antibiotics and what they do to us, you know, and what they strip us of? Would you give your kid antibiotics every day to make sure he didn't get sick?
Well, absolutely not. But here's the issue from the industry side. Industry is saying, well, you know, we're producing all this food very cheaply, and people want cheap food. So the real message becomes that has to be put out there is, folks, we're paying too little for the food that we eat. It's not of good nutritional quality. We need to, if we will spend more for good quality food, we will spend less for medical care.
Right. If
and
you
there,
don't,
there's
if,
the trade-off.
If you spend 5% more of your income on food for the next 20 years, but you don't get diabetes when you're 35, you will come out a net saver. But the thing is, it's hard to go to a poor person and say, hey, you
right.
got to pay more for food. You know, so the
it's hard to go to anybody because we're all paying the cost of health insurance at
which
this
is,
point.
Which is why
and
you
say,
need...
And say you're at 16% for of your income is going to go to health insurance and medical costs, but now we want you to pay 12% again or 14% again on your food. Now you're paying a disproportionate level, and I think that's the hard thing that has to change,
yeah.
and why it's got to be
a
bigger change.
And it's why you need government to step in, because if you know the capitalist model says I'll buy the cheapest food I can buy, and you know you can't say to an individual, but the societal costs overall are going to be so huge down the line. You know, that's the role of government regulation in a capitalist society.
Government regulation in this case, they have to come in and say to the producers, say for example, a hog producer, look, if this amount of effluence, and this is you know waste product from animals, was being produced by humans, we would obligate this facility to have a sewage treatment plant, so that if they would just enforce the environmental protection laws that are on the books and the wastewater treatment laws that are on the books for humans to apply them to any production facility that's producing this much excrement, if they would do this, there wouldn't be a need for any additional regulation. The problem is that industry, owning 99% of the production with all that money, is fighting and pretty much shutting down the EPA, both on a state level and on a federal level, from doing the job that they were, quite interestingly enough, enacted by Republicans in the early 70s to do.
You know, I think we need to explain to the audience, and a lot of people know this already, that when you have a traditional farm, when you have, you know, the red barn image in your head of a farm, the way that excrement is dealt with is, you know, you rotate your animals through your fields in which your crop is, and that, you know, there is... That amount of excrement
is absorbed by nature
and is
fertilizer
and good for a field. I remember my friends David Page and Barbara Shin opened a plant. We were going to plant a field, and we're talking about a field that they were going to plant. I think they wound up opening Shin Vineyard somewhere else, but they talked about a field across from a house they used to own, and part of that field had been fenced in as a cow. They had some cows out to pasture there for years. And part of the field had just been open field. And if you looked at the grass where the fence had come down, right, and the cows hadn't been there for a year, but you saw a line, and the grass was green and lush and beautiful where the cows were, but it wasn't on the other side. You knew where that fence had been, where the cows hadn't been able to go.
Absolutely.
So on a normal traditional farm, that stuff is used again in the farm in a very natural way. When you have a confinement animal feeding operation, like most of our food is raised in, you produce on a small bit of land millions and pounds and thousands of tons of excrement, and that's more than that land can absorb. And so you took something that, if it were spread out over a large enough area and it was never concentrated that much, would be a normal part of nature and just be absorbed back in, and you create a toxic sludge. And God forbid there's a flood, because then that's everywhere.
Well, again, I want to reiterate what Francis just said. It's not just normal. What would be something that is useful? What is something that the world could use in the right amount, in the right place, becomes toxic.
And laden with antibiotics. Isn't that crazy?
Well, this is the real problem, too. They're finding in areas where they use a lot of water, as we know, in processing animals, and they're finding that where there has been these animals raised and a lot of excrement introduced into the soils, that they're finding bacteria as well as antibiotics either in the ground, you know, the groundwater. You go down to the water table below, you're pulling it out in a well. In fact, there was a massive organic spinach recall due to E. coli. Well, they weren't putting, you know, there's no E. coli involved in raising spinach, but the water table, the underground aquifer that they were pulling from for irrigation, had been tainted because of a very densely packed feedlot that had been leaching excrement down into the soil and the various sublayers, and it quite frankly infected the aquifer.
And they blamed the spinach producer. I mean,
well,
if you
the
read
spinach
the
producer was where they started, but fortunately, you know, the EPA and the government did follow that one back and found out, whoa, And so this is not, we found out there that a high density feedlot like this, if not properly managed, and quite frankly, high density implies that there's too many animals for the ground to absorb all this, can lead to catastrophic consequences.
But you know, only those of us in the business and in you know, the know of this kind of thing ever really heard this, the last part of that story.
Yeah, yeah.
The, you know, for most of Middle America, all they heard was that spinach was tainted, and it was organic spinach at that,
right,
was tainted. And so there was this whole big issue.
There were even stories of like, well, is organic really good for you? You know, implying somehow that, you know, organic and small producers are at fault for these, for, you know, making a lot of people sick, when really it's just, it's quite the opposite.
Well, and again, just to switch back for a second, you know, we're talking about people having access and will they pay more for it? You know, I think that people that are educated, that do read, and more and all levels of our society are becoming aware of issues around food. The biggest issue for a lot of folks has been access to good quality food. And so you have certain lower income neighborhoods that have been food deserts. One of the solutions to this has been that green markets are aligning themselves with large congregations, religious congregations in these communities, to create like a CSA associated with a church. And therefore, good food is coming in. People are learning how to cook again. And because they see within their own, you know, their own congregation that, oh, 40% of us are way too heavy. A lot of us have diabetes. This is all related to our diet. It's not genetics.
There's a great... Go ahead, George.
Yeah, well, the key is just access becomes the big issue now, too. So
access and education, especially education of young people. And if you look at Jamie Oliver's show that he did in America, where he went to a small town, and I forget the name
Brilliant
of the show.
Show.
Do you remember the name of that, George?
No, I don't. Yeah. I'm sure if I can, I'm sitting here at a computer, I'll bring it up.
You know what? We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side, and we'll tell you about Jamie Oliver's show, which is available on Hulu. You can watch it for free. And we're going to get down to some specific things that George recommends that we support on, that we should do as a society, that the government should do, and you can be knowledgeable about and be able to maybe, I don't know, call your congressman, or at least be able to hold your own in an argument when you're talking to your friends, or maybe even change your mind. You never know. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're having a spirited, I say, conversation with George Faison. He is co-owner of DeBraga and Spittler in New York, and becoming one of the nation's foremost advocates from the supplier side for sustainably raised meats and animal husbandry and responsible agriculture and food production overall. We talked about a show that we were going to look up, the Jamie Oliver show, where he goes to a small town and sort of changes the paradigm of how people eat and uses as part of his change the schools and also a local congregation, just like you talked about. What was the name of that show?
I believe Food Revolution.
Food Revolution, Jamie Oliver. It was really good.
You know, one of the things I think it's important to point out to our audience is that George could make a lot of money. George has got a great network of people that he knows. George could make a lot of money selling a lot of these products that we're talking about here, but has chosen to kind of go the high road. I'm going to say to some of these better products, better producer, better farms, and make that the focus of his business. And I think that's really great. Not everybody's making that same choice.
You know, we talked about antibiotics before, and the reason that subtherapeutic antibiotics are given in disproportionately in large operations like that is to keep the animals alive in conditions in which the animals would die. And so think about, you know, those old movies where, like, they're trying to torture the prisoner to get the information out of him, and the Nazi doctor, comes in and keeps him alive so they can keep torturing him. That's the life of an animal in a confinement animal feeding operation. Is that a fair analogy, George?
Well, even I would have to say that's a touch extreme, but it's not so much that they would die as that they would not gain weight readily and therefore would not be something that the producer could sell.
All right, so let's talk about...
Yeah, it's like kids who go back to school in the fall. They've been hanging out at the family, and all of a sudden you put them in a classroom with about 30 other people they don't know, and everybody's bringing in a different germ set, bacteria set from their individual home. They all, 3 weeks later, everybody's got a cold.
But if you were... There are two different reasons that people... antibiotics are used in beef cattle. One is because it speeds the rate at which they absorb nutrients and grow. And the other
Correct.
Is because in such an unnaturally confined area, isn't it also to relieve disease pressure? Wouldn't disease pressure just decimate that whole operation if they didn't use subtherapeutic antibiotics?
Disease pressure, but also it's more about the animal getting sick because of a rapid change in diet. You're taking, in terms of beef, all cattle are grass-fed up to a certain point. And if that, they're on pasture. So say at 12 months, they're put onto a feedlot, and they're switched from a diet that's a grass diet, which they're the only animals in the world that can take grasses and turn them into protein. And then they're switched to something that's extremely nutrient dense, but, in terms of carbohydrates, which is corn. And it's like switching from a vegetarian lettuce diet and putting you onto a dairy diet overnight. It disrupts the animal's digestive system. And that, with the confinement, the tight quarters in the feedlot, which you put that all together, you're going to have an animal that has a propensity to get sick. So one of the keys to that adjustment is give them some antibiotics so they won't get sick. It's what we call subtherapeutic. Rather than wait till they get sick, we know they're going to get sick, so let's just put the antibiotics in the food. And it's really insidious in the hog and the poultry, because those animals never spend any of their time outside. A chicken is killed and was raised in 6 weeks. A hog is raised in 6 months. And the conditions of which, they're not outside. You have 200 million chickens killed every week. You have 2 million hogs killed every week. And less than 1% of that is naturally raised. So you have them in these tight, cramped conditions, no fresh air, no sunshine. It's stressful. It's tough on the animal system. And therefore, we know they're going to get sick. Give them the antibiotics up front.
Okay, as a result of giving the antibiotics, we've all seen that in hospitals now we have staph infections that are resistant to antibiotics. Sometimes you can die because there are bacteria that are resistant to antibiotic treatment, and there are some now that just are not treatable by antibiotics.
The big one is MRSA.
Right. MRSA. So MRSA has been tied, and a lot of these have been tied to farm workers who will get an infection that just won't heal.
Particularly hog farms.
So talk to us about what is the connection that leads us back to the farm with these? Because let's face it, we all then eat this meat, but with the farm workers themselves, I mean, getting an infection on a hog farm, that's a pretty dangerous thing, right?
Well, it's very dangerous, and when you can get cut, just you're working with animals, you're in barns, you get scratched, and all of a sudden you get a staph infection that doesn't respond to antibiotics. Look, germs are like anything. There's a great book that Jared Diamond wrote that won the Pulitzer Prize called Guns, Germs, and Steel. And
loved
so
it.
We come up with these things called antibiotics to fight germs. And germs are an organism. They don't want to die off. It's very rare that you'll be able to totally kill a germ without it morphing into something else. A perfect example is the flu. It always changes. So they're always coming up with the next year's vaccination. And the same thing happens on a hog farm. You've got a lot of germs. You have a lot of effluents in that facility. The animals are sick. You're giving them antibiotics. Well, those germs don't want to die. So they morph into something else, and they become resistant to those antibiotics. You then get trans-species migration. You've heard of the avian flu or swine flu. And this is the danger of using antibiotics so freely or so cavalierly, if you will, because the particular version of that virus that might break out is going to be one that becomes a pandemic that won't respond to antibiotics. This is what everybody in the health industry is absolutely terrified of.
And we know the source of most. I mean, we could eliminate at least 70% or say 60% of antibiotic use by simply saying no. If you can't feed your 100 cows antibiotics that we might need in the hospital later to save a dying guy, sorry, you can't use it up on that. I mean, humans. How crazy is this, right? Humans need a prescription from a doctor to show that you need that antibiotic before you're allowed to go to the pharmacy and give it to yourself or your husband or your wife or your kid. Farmers,
well, quite frankly, if they'd apply the same thing to farmers, a vet would have to go out and check the flock and go, yep, they're sick, give them some antibiotics.
Yeah. I mean, how crazy is that?
Which, frankly, I have no problem with. You know, I want to eat antibiotic-free, hormone-free meat because I know that it's being treated better. But if what you told me was we only gave the cows antibiotics when they needed it, I'd be totally fine with that.
Right.
Well, here's another piece I want you guys to be aware of that's very insidious, and this comes into the marketing of these meats and how certain companies try to pass themselves off as being really good guys.
You're going to say the word natural, aren't you?
Well, the word natural, but it's even worse than that. So you have the word natural on a lot of products, which means absolutely nothing. It means that nothing was added to that meat at the plant where it was slaughtered. So it can be given harm. It can be given antibiotics. But what I was going to tie into was the issue of hormones. Hormones are not allowed to be used in poultry or hog production at all in the United States. Beef are the ones that get hormones. Dairy cattle are the ones that get hormones. We'll talk about the real danger of hormones in a second. But you get these hog farmers or these hog producers and these poultry producers, these big industrialists, putting advertising out that says our poultry is
hormone-free. Yeah, it's awesome. That's incredible. It's awesome.
What that does is I call it a deflection. It is a deflection in that, oh, wow, it must be good for me. It's hormone-free.
That's
it's
awesome.
It's not mentioning that it's laden with antibiotics to get it to the table.
Yeah, it's like when candy says fat-free on the label.
Right, it's all sugar, but no fat-free.
It's all sugar.
Fat-free.
Now, that is a huge issue that has not been addressed. I find it duplicitous advertising that if it was cigarettes, they would have outlawed it a long time ago. And so the agricultural lobby in this country has a disproportionate amount of power because 99% of the production is in their hands. And so these things are being perpetrated upon the culture, and the culture is not aware of how they're being manipulated.
And
this is a real problem.
And if you look at manipulation of signs, it was the same agricultural lobby that wanted to ban, and that did for a while, ban the ability to say milk is from cows raised with no artificial hormones. So they didn't want – they said, well, that's misleading because then you might think hormones are bad. I'm like, well, but it's not misleading. It says – hormones here, no hormones there.
Yeah. We once called it the New Jersey Dairy, what was it, Agriculture Department.
Oh, I forget the...
And we said, you know, we're trying to find hormones. This
we
is
spoke,
years and years
We spoke
ago.
To an Undersecretary of Agriculture.
Said, you know, we're trying to find some hormone-free milk that we can use in the restaurant. This is before there were labels and things. And what we were told is, well, I can't give you any. All milk has hormones.
Yeah. I was like, okay.
Do you remember that answer?
Yeah, we called the Department of Agriculture, and we got all the way up to an Undersecretary of Agriculture, not on the air, just for our restaurants, and we said, listen, we want to carry milk that doesn't have any recombinant bovine growth hormone, so we want to look for the hormone free milk, and he said, well, all milk has hormones. I said, yeah, I know all milk has hormones, and I used a word that starts with D in my head, and I said, you know, I'm looking for dairies that, because they couldn't label it as such, that you know, don't use recombinant bovine growth hormone. He's like, well, there's no hormones in the milk. I said, I understand that. I would like a list of dairies. Can you help me find some dairies that specifically don't use recombinant bovine growth hormone in the raising of the cattle that they then use to milk cows? He said, no, I can't give that to you. And I thought, really? You are so owned by the dairy industry.
Yes, exactly.
I completely owned.
It was shameful. It was one of the most shameful conversations
so
I've ever had.
So let's talk about the harm of hormones. And here's one that's going to hit home because I want to lead with the shocking one. And, you know, Mark and I have been talking about this for years. We haven't in a while, but you mentioned it too in your recent articles. So we add hormones to dairy cows that bring them to be able to produce milk faster, work on their mammary glands to make them much more productive, and they lactate, you know, almost around the clock, which is very not very good for the dairy cow.
Tough on a cow.
Tough on a cow. It shortens their lifespan because their bodies can't take it. But it's all about the mammary glands and producing milk. About the time we started to introduce hormones into dairy cows, we began to see early onset of menses in young girls. And, you know, it doesn't it just make sense that, you know, if our milk production, you know, has this hormone in it that is designed to bring on early, you know, milk production in cows, and then we have, you know, the same thing happen in the humans that eat the milk. Doesn't somebody say, I wonder if there's a connection there?
Well, here let's explain for the listeners the danger of women commencing menstruation early is that we have found definitively that the earlier the onset of menstruation in a young woman, the greater likelihood, the vastly greater likelihood that later in life she will find herself confronting breast cancer or cervical or uterine cancer. And this is an abomination. Europe has outlawed the use of hormones in beef and dairy production. They've outlawed the use of antibiotics in animal production as well, and except for truly therapeutic reasons, animals sick. But so here we are with the Europeans have said this makes no sense. You know, and to say that there's no residue, when, in other words, there's no hormones in the milk when you buy it because it's all passed through the system. Well, then explain to me, why does the International Olympic Committee hang on to blood and urine samples for 5 years after an event? Because they know that the industry, that they are going to find out in the preventative industry that their better and better tests will detect more and more minute particles of residue. So obviously something's going on in our culture for there to be this great a change in the onset of menstruation in young women in such a short amount of time. This is an evolutionary thing that happened in a revolutionary short time. To have that menstruation come on 20% quicker in a time span that was only over about 30 years. I mean, we're looking at humans being in the world and women being in the world for, what, you know, a billion years at least. So all of a sudden, when this time frame, that changes that much. What else was going on in that time frame?
Is there any data about Europe? Has Europe experienced the same sort of early change in the onset of menstruation for women?
Well, they saw this occurring, and they just put it together on a causal basis. This is the difficulty with a lot of these issues, is similar to global warming. Is there any real definitive proof, hard and fast? Studies are occurring right now. Some of the earlier studies have come out. I mean, my information on the hormone came from a Cornell study. So it's not like this was a pie-in-the-sky university. And, you know, so this is the difficulty. Do we wait until we have the definitive answer? It may be too late by then.
I just don't understand. I mean, I really do understand because it's money-driven. But what's taken us so long? Why? We know. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out where the cause is to some of these things, and what's taking us so long? I know it's money driven.
It's capitalist. It's money driven. They have their doctors who are claiming that, you know, there's no risk.
Well,
so, you know, whose scientists do you believe nowadays? This is the problem. Everybody can hire an expert.
Well, here's the other problem is the way that the European Union works, and before the European Union, most European countries worked, is if you introduce a new product or a new practice to the market, you have to prove that is safe in large studies before you can introduce it. In the United States, especially, and more so under the recent administrations of agriculture, and food in general, FDA as well, they have the term is GRAS, generally recognized as safe. And so, if something is determined by the government to be generally recognized as safe or similar to an existing product, you don't have to prove that it's safe before you can feed it to millions and millions of people. We are the case study, you know, which is bass ackwards, you know. It's like you put it out in the population and then people get sick, or, you know, there's long-term ramifications. And afterwards you could say, you know what, this has been on the market for 20 years. We've made 5 million people sick. Maybe we can try and take it off the market now. But you know what? Now there's so much money and so many jobs tied to it that it's much harder to get that off the market after the fact. But that's how we do it.
Well, it's not like they found cyanide in the Tylenol. This is the problem, is that they are deflecting the smoking gun. A lot of the information that is being used to base, you know, my opinions and their opinions is causal, as opposed to, you know, definitively determined in a mutually agreed upon scientific study. And yet that's the big problem, too, is that we're in such a strident, diversified society that, you know, the mutually agreed upon criteria are hard to come by. I mean, I referred to this earlier, but the Clean Air Act and the Environmental Protection Agency were passed and put in place by the Richard Nixon administration, a Republican administration. It's hard to believe that that kind of legislation would pass today.
But, you know, at our airports, we err on the side of caution. Okay, we make sure that you know there's not going to be another tragedy. There's not going to be another major incident that's on an airplane. Why do we have to wait for there to be another major incident due to these farms and the way
global
things are raised? And why do we need to wait for that? I just don't understand. Why can't we err on the side of caution?
Again, you know, the airplane thing is very dramatic and it's very quick. The issue that somebody who gets hit with MRSA, it's very quick for them, but it's still such a small subset of the population. It's not in everybody's collective consciousness as radically as an airplane hijacking. And I know that some people may find this to be an inappropriate comparison, but when you think about the numbers of people that are being impacted like this, it isn't one spectacular event. But more people are dying from this, from the cancer, these cancers that are being caused earlier. MRSA impacted 18,000 people last year. So it's just not getting the attention it needs to get. Again, I go back to Representative Louise Slaughter. She's fighting a tough battle. And the FDA, in their infinite wisdom, only outlawed one antibiotic of the many she was trying to have, you know, banned from animal use. And that only amounted to perhaps 2% of the antibiotic use in animals. So the resistance is just huge. You know, the fear that large producers are going, well, if you make us do that, there'll be mass starvation in society. People
which is ridiculous.
Won't be able to, there won't be enough food for people to eat.
You know, the other thing is the American system, we as Americans respond very well to the action movie, you know, to the heroic, like, the fire, the explosion, the heart attack, even our medical system. Our emergency rooms are fantastic, but getting checkups to poor kids so that they don't have heart attacks is, we're not so good at that. You know, it's about, I think that in our society, we are set up for the catastrophe and we like the action movie. But, you know, if you had better primary care for people, you would have fewer emergency room visits and you would have less need for that. But that's not how we work. We're all about the flash emergency cowboy coming over the hill thing. And I think that's detrimental to us. I want to talk about one issue, or I want to ask you, George, about one issue. The issue that often comes up, and when we do public speaking, the issue we're often faced with, I mean, several times now, is, you know, isn't, you know, what you say is great, Francis, what you say about good food, what you say about whole food, that's all terrific for you, Mr. Middle Class, Upper Middle Class, restaurant owner, entrepreneur guy, but what about me on a fixed income? What about, you know, poor people? You know, aren't you like the, you can get on your high horse and go to Whole Foods and go to Wegmans and buy your whole stuff. I think that being able to pay more, and I think that specifically restaurants and restaurant chefs and owners have a larger impact in the community and how they eat. We can sort of go in when it's still really expensive to try something new or try something old again. But I think that doesn't that eventually open up the with economies of scale, letting that percolate back down to the individual people? I mean, it can't come in cheap. But I've seen stuff like heritage birds, different breeds come in because restaurant chefs get behind them, and then they actually get more affordable and more widespread in the distribution system over time. Is that pie in the sky, or does that really work that way?
Well, in the context of heritage breeds and such, it may be pie in the sky, but in the context of birds raised without antibiotics, now, you know, there's issues around the poultry industry. 99% of the chickens today are an extreme hybrid that was raised to convert feed to flesh very rapidly and to have very large breasts, so we get a lot of white meat, breast meat. If we just took the antibiotics out of that food, it would not make it three times as expensive. It might make it 20% more expensive. on the context of beef, say grass-fed beef or beef raised without antibiotics or hormones, yes, they're more expensive to raise this way, but people can eat lesser cuts. The lesser cuts of those animals are not what's attracting the premium in the market. So somebody can buy a London broil off of a grass-fed steer for almost the same money as a commodity London broil in the supermarket. And yeah, you got to know how to cook it. You got to roast it real slow. You got to slice it real thin. But then they can also eat a smaller portion. We don't need as much protein. So we need to learn to eat better quality, to work with lesser cuts, and to eat it less frequently and in smaller portion. This is how any income class can afford to eat healthily. That's a misnomer. We're trying to scare people that way. The other thing that's been very successful have been these CSA associations I referred to and community gardens. You can take, you know, in the size of your dining room, you can grow a lot of produce.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget about that.
Yeah, our dining room doesn't get very much sunlight, though.
No, I know, but you know what I mean. Smack you. I've been talking to you about that atelier for years.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, but in a small amount of space that's got proper sun exposure, you can grow a lot of produce. I mean, what was it 100 years ago when all these southern European immigrants were coming over and they moved into these brownstones that had a little front lawn? And within weeks of their arrival, they'd all been turned into gardens.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
I remember my grandmother's house in Brooklyn had a fig tree and grapevines. And I mean, they had, you know, 100 square feet of property.
There's a phenomenal statistic out there that was just out. I quoted it on last week's show, I think, or the week before. I had it because I had the paper before me. Talked about the percentage of food in 1955 that came from, you know, what were then called victory gardens, people's gardens in their house. And the percentage of produce that people ate that they had grown themselves or their neighbors had grown, it was something like 40%. And what people always find when they plant a garden and want to eat out of it is the amount of food you get out of a little garden, if you plant it well and tend it well, is amazing, absolutely amazing. Hey, George, I'm afraid we need to leave it there, but I've really enjoyed talking
great
to you.
Great talk, George.
Stuff.
Well, I feel like I've just been hanging out in the restaurant trying everything on your wine list and having a little chat. Oh, I did that.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't today, though. It wasn't today. You can find out. You can find out more about George Faison and DeBragan Spitlader at our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening.
Yeah,
to
and also send them to our website, DeBragan.com.
Yep, we shall. And if you're in the business, by the way, George is an excellent resource. And this is a non-paid promotional announcement. He's an excellent resource for sourcing stuff, but he's also a great resource for information on things that we really all should care about. And so you might want to check that out. And again, you can find out all that information at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. Smart guy, good meat. I love that Bittman wrote his industry article and posted it on the New York Times blog.
Right, and realize that how Francis and I are getting all this stuff is George puts out a newsletter to the industry that and he talks about very, very important issues. One of the issues that he mentioned, one of the statistics he gave, is that not that long ago, prime meat, 6% of the meat was prime meat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are now down to only 1.5% of our meat is graded as prime, and that's just because of what we do to the animals. They don't have enough time for the muscles to absorb the fat in the right way to become prime meat anymore.
Here's a little definition, by the way. Choice, you know, when you see choice in the supermarket, this means it's choice. Choice is the second grade of meat.
Mm-hmm.
Prime is usually very expensive. And prime is, most restaurants don't have prime. And to be honest with you, I've been to a lot of restaurants that said they had prime meat, and it's not prime meat.
I want to also tell you, though, when you, a lot of people ask, you know, why are your steaks so good? Why is the meat here so good? Why can't I do this at home? Part of that is because you don't have access to the same types of meat.
Right.
You can't buy in a supermarket the type of meat that we can buy directly from DeBragan Spitlader. It's very hard to get the top of the top is really reserved for top level restaurants.
Well, and if you go to, you know, the great butchers in New York, you can ask for prime meat, and you'll
exactly.
look at it and you'll see the difference in color of the meat. And actually, here in Jersey, I have to give a shout out to a store that I love. It is Wegmans. Mm-hmm. And usually at Wegmans, you'll go to their beautiful butcher counter full of great choice meat, and they'll have one or two things of prime, whether it's a porterhouse, or and they'll have something there that they'll slice off for you prime. But it's, you know, $24 a pound.
You need to know that if you're going to buy prime meat, you're going to pay top dollar for prime meat. That's just what it costs.
But yeah, that's what he said. And then there's also select. Select is
below choice. You need to know that select is below choice. You basically, the really, you know, I don't buy, I wouldn't buy anything below select ever.
I wouldn't buy select either.
And I wouldn't buy select. That's,
you know,
that's
it's funny.
Kind of,
whenever you're in a supermarket and they have some stuff is labeled choice, nobody ever labels things select. They just don't label it. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I remember I went to, because I buy, and I have to say, for meat now, I try to eat less meat at home, you know, and so I'll do a lot of cheeses, I'll do some vegetables, but when I cook at home, which isn't that often because I'm often in the restaurant, when I go to buy meat, I was making a beef stew last year, and I thought I had cubed beef in the refrigerator from I wasn't planning that, so I didn't bring anything home from the restaurant. I thought I had stuff in the refrigerator from this Wegmans, and I didn't. And so I had to run to the store, and literally my guests were coming over in a short period of time. I needed to clean the house, and so I ran to the local supermarket, which is a big chain supermarket, and I picked up stew meat, right?
Francis doing the little air quotes.
I put it in the pan, and in a lot of these old stews, what you do is you'll take that cured beef, right, and you'll throw it in a hot pan, and you'll brown it, and then you'll brown you put a little flour on it, and you'll brown that again. And that's sort of the basis, so that caramelized outer bit is the basis of a wonderful beef stew, is doing like a beef bourguignon kind of stew. And I have this great cast iron Dutch oven. And I got the cast iron Dutch oven hot, and I had caramelized my onions in there, and I had I had cooked down some of the vegetables in there, and I threw a little oil in the pan, and I threw in the beef, and I watched as so much liquid
water
expressed out of this beef that it was floating. And you can't brown something that's floating
exactly.
in liquid.
Exactly. When it's wet like that, that's just so you know, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are home cooks. You really wet things don't caramelize on the outside. You can't get that crispy outer shell on a scallop or on a piece of beef or whatever if it's wet, if it's damp.
And so,
But when the water's coming from the inside, there's nothing you can do to stop it.
So here I've got this thing. It looks like a soup. Looks like a beef soup. It's nothing is in the pan but the meat I threw in there and all of the water that is expressed out of there. So I'm cooking it, and so I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll cook the liquid down. And I'm like, that's disgusting. What? And I smell. I wasn't too happy. It was fine. It didn't smell
rancid. Right. It wasn't rancid.
But here I'm looking, and it's basically this murky brown water that I'm boiling down. But what's happening is, my stew meat is now boiling in the water that's come out of the meat.
Right.
And I'm like, this is not.
And that's exactly what happens. That's why you can't brown it. Your water is boiling around
your
meat.
And I could brown the boiled meat when it came out later. I guess I could scoop it out and pour the water off. And I thought, I got to get in the car to go Wegmans. But I was, because most of the stuff we have in our houses, we take from the restaurant.
We don't get a lot of experience with those types
and
of things.
And I was just, I'm like, really? I can't even get, it's not possible to make stew out of that. Mm-hmm. And God forbid, even if you didn't take the step of browning the meat to begin with, all of that water would have expressed into your stew.
Exactly.
I'm shocked at that. So that shouldn't happen.
So the answer here is buy better meat, use less of it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's really the answer.
Bad news is you have to pay more for what you're eating. Good news is you're fat anyway. That's America. welcome to America. Anyway.
Have you been to my house?
I include myself in that as well. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com.